That's like being an entrepreneur. You learn so much and you fail so much. It'll be a fun discussion.
Absolutely. You want to enter a space that you're really needed. So that's a good thing too. Welcome everybody. This is Tuesday Morning Grind episode number 58. And there is a phenomena going on. You've probably all heard about it called CMMC. There's a lot of security going on in the federal space. So I thought that that would be a great thing to try to demystify and provide some guidance on. So today we have with us Jack Scott. Jax is an expert in the federal space and well beyond that in all topics security, also an author of a book, been on a lot of podcasts. So Jax, we're very excited to have you. Welcome.
Christian, I am thrilled to be here. When you guys had initially reached out to me and asked me to come on the show and talk about the Fed space and the CMMC, I was like kid in a candy store. So it'll be a fun discussion.
Absolutely. So let's start off with this. How in the world did you get into security and in just like federal? How did you become the expert in federal space in general?
Yeah, it's really an interesting story. Military really is what put me into the federal space. So that's, and I've been there for 18 years, active duty, and then National Guard and Reserve time. And then in 2008, I transferred from the job that I was doing in the military to information technology. And that really started my path in where I'm at today. In 2008, though, I didn't realize, because at that time there wasn't cybersecurity. So I didn't realize there was this whole world of IT. I really worked in the space of network development. I would go out and build networks out of scratch in the middle of fields. That was my job. And then on the side, I did help desk and SharePoint coordination. And I just really didn't enjoy it. And then kind of fast forward, again, very much military-esque space. I went from IT, I became an officer in electronic warfare, so working on the electromagnetic spectrum. And then in right around 2014, 15, the military said, you know, EW is going to move into cyber. It's going to literally, we're going to put it under the cyber branch because, you know, that makes sense. And I'm going, oh my gosh, I have to go back to cyber slash IT because I didn't know at that time there was still a difference. And today, I'm so happy that I was forced back into that space because I've been around IT and computers since I was a little kid. My father was an IBM programmer, still is today, actually, shockingly, in his 70s, because he's so good at what he does. But he worked on computers in like the size of huge rooms. So it's always been in my blood and kind of in my, I guess, my genetics. So today, I'm very passionate about, I do cyber threat intel. That was one of the areas that I worked in for quite a while. But really, my passion is driven through governance, risk, and compliance, the GRC space, and then even more prominently, the Fed space, NIST, CMMC, FedRAMP. And I've been doing that for about a year now, really honed in on that. But before that, I was really doing NIST implementation and controls when I was doing IT for the government. Yeah. So everything kind of brings us back to here. Yeah.
What branch of the military did you serve?
Army. Yeah, Army. I did Army, and then in 2015, I was part of a unit called the Cultural Support Team, and it was about 2010, 2011, I joined that program, and that fell under the Special Operations Command. So that's when I started doing some really cool intel. That's when I got into intel, started doing some intel operations in that space, and it was, and that's where I've spent most of my career until recently. I've decided to kind of transfer kind of back into the conventional Army side, but really like a cyber focus.
About half our leadership team is prior Army. So Christian White, our co-founder, he was a West Point grad, captain U.S. Army. Jess Lucas, she was a West Point grad, Army officer. And then we have a guy named Tim on our ops side. He was not a West Point grad, but he was an Army officer. So we are surrounded by a bunch of you guys. So you are awesome. Cool. So you got in, I guess when did you transition out? So you transitioned out of the military into consulting, I guess. What year was that?
Well, I actually left the military full time in 2015. And so I went from an active duty status into a guard or an MDA status. And I launched my company right around that time. And my company was really focused in the intelligence space. And it was more human intelligence. But we also provided OSINT. So what I would do is I recruited these elite level women from either elite level federal positions, law enforcement, or military special ops positions. And we would work as subcontracts for companies like Triple Canopy. It would all be a women owned company. And we would go in, it would be an all woman team. And we would embed into certain cells. And what we would do is bring pattern of life and intelligence reporting back to these organizations. And we used OSINT to do this as well. And in 2018-19, that's when I got an opportunity to deploy to Eastern Europe to support an operation. It's an enduring operation called Atlantic Resolve. You can Google it. It's all open source stuff. But it's an operation that it supports the NATO operation and fosters those relationships with our European partners. And I went out there thinking I was going to do electronic warfare, but in all actuality, I started doing a ton of cyber development, because I wouldn't say operations. We don't really do a lot of like cyber warfare because of permissions and authorities, because of federal governments and everything. And we can dive into that with the CMMC stuff. But that's when I really started noticing there was a different side to cyber, and my love for cyber really started developing right around 2019. But I also started to see our lack of those private and public partnerships and how that has impacted us in a negative way, because we aren't being able to impact the battle space the way that we could because of the lack of those partnerships.
Where do you think that entrepreneurial bug come from? Because like you went from military, started your own business, you have a great brand now, you're still very entrepreneurial. Is that just something you had inside of you, or do you have like parents that are entrepreneurs? Where'd that come from?
My dad did own a technology company when I was a kid, like a tiny tot. And I don't think that really placated a lot about me and my entrepreneurism. I don't know where it came from. I can tell you at 19 years old, I started my own business. And a lot of people don't know this about me, but at 19, I launched a perfume business where I would sell name brand and knockoff perfume out of the trunk of my car. And I had a storefront, but it was mostly out of this trunk of my car. I would hire all these kids. I was a kid, but I would hire all these kids, and we would literally hustle all around America throughout the week, Monday through Thursday. And we would go to states, different states, and we would pop our hoods. And that back then, gas was only $1.19. I'm dating myself, but that was my first business. And I started two companies, and I was making at that time, I remember making like $1,700, $2,000 a week. And I was 19. And it was wild. So I've started a lot of businesses. I run a cybersecurity advisory firm now, but it's the same name of my intel company. And before that, I had a gun business. So I had a firearms license, and I would teach women, primarily women, but males, how to shoot and do combat related skills training, combatics training, active shooter training. I keep telling myself, Christian, that one of these days when I truly believe like where I'm at with my company now, Outpost Gray, like something's going to stick. It's going to stick. And that's like being an entrepreneur. You learn so much. And you fail so much, but eventually you figure it out. And I feel like I've finally started to figure it out.
I think that's the story of entrepreneurism is like there's this kind of myth that, you know, you go to a consulting firm for 2 years, then you go get an MBA, and then you study the market conditions and you launch right into this perfect business model that goes against funding. But I don't know anyone who's done it that way. Pretty much everyone that I know is like, you know, taking their looks, getting beaten up, figure out what to do. Pivot a couple times, and then all of a sudden something sticks and they wind up somewhere where they're like, well, I never would have invented this business on day one, but I'm glad I'm here. So that's just how it is, I guess. Let's move into CMMC. So I have a cursory understanding of the federal space, done a lot of stuff with NIST just because people like that framework. I have an outsider's perspective on CMMC just because I've been somewhat aware of the drama. I'll call it drama. I don't know if it is drama in terms of they thought CMMC was going to be released and there were delays on it. Then there was kind of a reformatting of it. So I'll start off this way. Why another certification scheme? Because I know there's NIST 853, there's FedRAMP, there's NIST 800-171. Now CMMC came down the pipeline. What was the logic, or who's the market for folks trying to get that formal certification?
I love this question because I think it's really critical to understand why CMMC was even created in the first place. And so taking like a few steps back, really taking a step back all the way to 9/11 and the impacts of 9/11. And then that's when we came out with a lot of laws and legislation around data sharing and the Data Privacy Act. And it was really at that point that CMMC was starting to get created. Because CMMC, the purpose behind CMMC is to secure and to secure our critical infrastructure and our supply chain that could directly impact the defense industrial space, or the DIB is what we'll call it. And it was a way of creating a certification to ensure that these organizations that worked in the DIB space were indeed compliant, and they weren't just checking a box like had been happening for a very long time and doing what we call self-assessing or self-attestation, but really just checking a box and not actually doing any of the compliance things or hiring a team to do it. And therefore, it was leaving our entire infrastructure vulnerable to an attack. So we saw that it takes a long time, as we know, in the federal government to get anything done. It moves like pond water. So, you know, 9/11 happened, all of these executive orders came out, memorandums came out, and it led us to where we're at today. And so CMMC, the initial framework, the five levels that we initially had were really designed still at three. And what I mean by that is you had a level one and a two that was kind of a, let's get you ready for level three, and then a four to get you ready for level five. And the government even stated they had not, they were not planning to do or to provide any contracts to any organizations that were going to be at level two and level four. So the purpose was to give organizations more of a framework, and they were still leveraging NIST, NIST 171 and 172. But what they did for the first CMMC was to create these Delta controls and create additional controls. It was really a CMMC initiative where they're like, well, we're gonna do all this NIST stuff, and then we're gonna create these other controls to make you additionally secure. But what happened is when they came in with CMMC 2, the revision of it, they removed those in-between layers that really didn't need to be there in the first place. So two and four went away, really condensed everything down. There was less confusion. And then they took away on level two, they took away those additional CMMC controls. Now, where we're at right now, and I actually, before this interview, I went into the CMMCAB, the accreditation body website, and I listened to the most recent town hall, just to verify, to make sure nothing had changed. Nothing has changed in the fact that they are still unclear, the government, on what is going to constitute CUI, controlled and classified data. How do we know what CUI data is in an organization? There's some clarity, but it's very gray. And then the other thing is like the controls and the measures. What is that ultimately going to look like? Are there going to be additional controls? Are they going to keep it within the 171 and 172? So it's still at a place of, we're just waiting. We're at a waiting game right now.
So I guess just to recap, early on, like we get this request too. You have a contractor that's probably several layers deep in the supply chain. So like a contractor that's doing work for someone who helps some little component of manufacturing something for the defense space. And then part of that due diligence to get the contract is they have to demonstrate a minimum level of security. Today, it's largely based on either NIST 800-171 or NIST 853, 171 typically being the one. But like you said, the way that that's handled today is a self-attestation typically. They're like, yep, I'm doing it. And there's not a lot of validation to prove out that they're doing it or how well they're doing it, which obviously leaves some attack vectors open. The CMMC was supposed to come behind that to add some level of assurance, not unlike SOC 2 or ISO certification, just like an independent party validating that there's a minimum level of security. And then I think the big driver, though, from what I was hearing from the outside, is it was going to be in federal contracts. Like it was going to be a mandate that if you want to do business in this space, it's attached to revenue, you have to demonstrate it. And then you kind of recap some of the controversy. Do you have a sense? Because I'm with you right now. I don't even really know what to advise clients. I'm telling them, hey, they're going to do it. Like, there's CMC is going to be a thing. So there's no harm in preparing yourself for that certification, because there's a lot of best practices anyway. But what about timing? Do you have a sense? I mean, is it sometime this year, 3 years away? Has anyone made progress enough to kind of figure that out?
What the word is, and even from listening to the December town hall, and the accreditation body does a town hall every month. I don't believe they've done a January one. They may have and just not uploaded it to the site. But as of December and some of the other data that I just did a quick research on to make sure, hey, are we still on the holding pattern? What does it look like? It's still 9 months to 24 months. Now, what the accreditation body has said is they would give incentives to certain organizations to go ahead and work with a registered practitioner or registered practitioner organization, RPO, to start getting them prepared for their assessment to work with the C3 PAO. Now, what do these incentives look like? That is still unclear. There's incentives around, well, if you go ahead and get certified now, we'll extend your certification out for 1 to 2 years. Really, that just puts you at the same spot of, say they do go ahead and they get everything lined out with the new rulemaking, because that's the big holdup right now is the rulemaking, trying to figure out the 32 CFR and the 48 CFR, which is the DFARS, which you mentioned federal contracting. That's what they have to update, is that 32 and the 48, because the 48, it goes into DFARS for contractors to know what are those contract requirements that I have to have, solicitation and the acquisition process. Mm-hmm. And that takes a long time. So until that happens, they're trying to get these organizations to get on board to start the process. But to be really honest with you, Christian, it's hard for me as a business owner to say, hey, I don't know if it's going to be another like 6 months or 2 years, but I would encourage you to work with an RPO and spend, and they don't know the number, but let's say the number right now that people are throwing around is between 150 to 250 to get assessed, to prepare for the assessment, to go in there. And one of the big things, Christian, is identifying not only if you have CUI data, but where it is, because a lot of leaders don't know where that's at. So you need an organization to come in with a tool that can go in and identify this data and then do a pin test on your network and do all of these things to prepare you. That's a lot of money for a what if, for yeah. When. So it's really hard for, and then you don't know what your incentive is. So right now it's like, do I do it? Do I not? And that's hard for these small organizations, these small companies that may only have 20 employees, 50 employees, because that's a lot of the DIB space is, it's a lot of smaller organizations. It's not these Raytheons, Deloitte's. They're not going to have that issue. They're going to, 250K is no big deal. They can prepare for this. It's the smaller ones that are going to have a little bit of a struggle making it happen.
So bottom line is, so are there steps that, let's say you're a medium-sized organization. Like, I think the small contractors, it's going to be tough for them. Like you said, if you're 20 people or something, and yeah, there's a lot of calculations and business cases and stuff that have to be considered for those folks to take action. Totally get that. But let's say that you're a medium-sized business that has some appetite to take on a security initiative. What types of things are you recommending they do now? Should they go ahead and start implementing a set of best practices? Should they go ahead and start aligning to a certain framework? Should they engage third parties already? What should those kind of firms be doing?
I would encourage anybody that's listening right now, like, what are the first things that I need to do? What do I need to do to become compliant? I want to work in this space. Or maybe they don't work in this space, but they know they need to start becoming compliant. I would say start the conversation. Reach out to vendors that work in the compliance space. Start talking to them. What that's going to do, and what I've seen with a lot of organizations, is that's going to help you understand your own scope. Like, what do you need done? Do you have CUI data? Do you have CUI data that's not actually deemed critical? It's non-critical. So maybe you're going to fall in the other category where you can do self-attestation for yourself. But you need to start the conversation. You need to start working with these professionals. Get a cost estimate. Start putting that as part of your budget. But don't be afraid. I think that's what we do sometimes as cybersecurity professionals, is we're like, oh, well, that's pending, but it's not here yet. I'm not really going to worry about it. I'll just deal with it later. It's sometimes out of fear. Sometimes it's out of like budgetary constraints, but having a conversation with vendors, like your organization, doesn't really, it costs time. Until you sign on the dotted line and you bring the team in, you can develop a relationship, talk with them about scope, the cost, and then what is it going to entail? And then the level of maturity, where do you want to be? You know, if you're outside of CMMC, you could do low, medium, or high. What does your organization need? And I think that's the big step, is at least just starting that conversation.
Yeah. I'm kind of, when I hear you talk and the research I've done on CMMC is there's, you know, do you have that critical data, and that kind of drives scope? And that reminds me of PCI, where in PCI, it's all about the card data environment. And the trick, like what's become popular now after years and years of maturity, is limiting that scope of your card data as much as possible, thereby limiting the scope and efforts of your compliance initiatives. And part of me wonders if that phenomenon will happen also with CMMC, where maybe the trick is like just de-scoping yourself in terms of the data you're capturing, because you can still provide the service. Do you know if that's possible? Is it possible to like deburden yourself of the critical data, but still provide all of the services around it? Or do they also take into consideration like some of the services you're providing? Or is that an unknown at this point?
That was actually mentioned in the town hall in the assessment. What the CEO, Matthew Travis, mentioned was your overall assessment obviously is going to be dictated by your CUI, but there's going to be other factors that are considered into what is getting assessed, such as if you have a SOC, maybe that doesn't, you know, that has the possibility of holding CUI data, but it doesn't hold the CUI data. You have that over here in another area that's really secure. Well, that is still going to be assessed because there's a possibility of housing it. Same with if you have a SaaS product, a cloud environment that could possibly store CUI data, that can also be assessed. So that's really hard to say, okay, I want to get rid of this data. Likely, you're not going to be able to get rid of that CUI data. You're going to have to figure out your best approach of like doing micro segmentation. But to keep in mind, even if you micro segmentate it off of the network and you do zero trust, even if you have other toolings on your network that could possibly store CUI data, they're going to have to be assessed.
Yep. Yeah, this is such, I feel it's necessary on the one hand. Like cybersecurity is obviously a critical issue that our country and companies in the country are dealing with. We got to deal with it. But on the other side of that coin, it's like, man, it's really confusing out there because you have FedRAMP, you have self-attestation, you have the alphabet soup of different regulatory and compliance frameworks, and I have CMMC. So I can see how a business is feeling frustrated right now trying to navigate all of those requirements. Anyway, just a little bit of empathy out there. I know everybody in our space, you're nodding your head. We all get it too. We're like, I'm sorry you're done with this. Let's try to get through it. But it's just, you can tell that we're like super early in our overall like worldwide maturity of cybersecurity is still very immature, even though we've been dealing with this for a decade or two now, because we still don't speak a common language. We're still figuring out how to regulate it and everything, which makes it kind of exciting to be in the space, because you're like, man, like where would we be in 10 years? Who knows? It'll be a really cool place to be.
In 10 years, I honestly think where we are today, it's going to be a completely different threatscape. I think GRC is going to be in a space that we can't even comprehend today, because in 5 years, emerging technology to include quantum computing is going to start getting fielded, not on the mainstream, but it's going to start being fielded into medical facilities, things like that. Mm-hmm. It's going to be commercial in 10 years. That's the projection that researchers and technologists are seeing. That alone, if you're familiar with quantum computing, yep, that a technology alone is going to entirely disrupt the threatscape and where we are within the cybersecurity space. Well, and GRC will be just completely different.
I agree, because it's going to break cryptography for all intents. Like, yeah, one of the things I've been excited about is like blockchain and crypto stuff. And the reason I'm excited about that is because of decentralization, because of immutability and things like that. However, the other side of that coin is quantum computing.
Yes.
So if you can like basically break all crypto with high speed computing, then you have kind of quantum computing versus quantum computing. So how fast can you encrypt it versus how fast can you decrypt it? So I agree. Like those are brand new dynamics that aren't even on our radar right now. that once that enters the picture is going to make everyone revisit everything. Plus stuff that I'm sure that I have no idea even exists right now that someone's working on and getting funding for. So it's an exciting place to be. Let's talk about, you wrote a book somehow in your spare time that you clearly have plenty of. And it's about let me just tell the title because it's Cybersecurity Career Master Plan. So it's a book that you helped co-author. Can you talk about that? And where I'd like to start is how in the heck did you find time to write it? Like, what was the writing process and how did you choose a topic? Like, what's the logistics behind writing a book?
Oh, man. Yeah. Writing a book. So glad I did it. I actually had to take a term off to write the book. I would be graduating this term right now had I not taken off a term to be able to do it. And it all started by an individual. It's all about networking. So I met an individual through a networking event that led me to Dr. Gerald Osher on the book. And he had actually reached out to me and said, hey, I'd like to write a book. Do you want to write one with me? It was like less than 5 minutes into the call because I did not think that's what the call was going to be about. I was going to pick his brain about writing a book. And then fast forward, the reason we have four co-authors on there is because he's a professor. He's a leader in cybersecurity. He runs a YouTube and he and I were both like, this is a lot. So we brought on two more co-authors to get more diversity. We also wanted to write the book with that piece of having diversity because of what the book is about. And as the book says, Cybersecurity Career Master Plan. And we really love that title because we designed the book for individuals either wanting to break into the industry or who were already in the industry wanting to pivot. And so Gerald and I put the outline together. We built it with that in mind because that is our passions of what we do. And I encourage anybody that's either in the industry, you know, they've been in for less than 5 years, maybe trying to understand a little bit more about the industry and what's out there to pick up the book, or those that are like, how do I break into the industry and, you know, and start my career in cybersecurity?
Yeah, I see basically any social media platform. I'm most heavily involved in LinkedIn is, I think probably, top two biggest controversies in cybersecurity right now is the job situation. Because on the one hand, you have these companies that are trying desperately to fill cybersecurity positions. There's millions of open positions right now in that. On the other hand, you hear these horror stories of people trying to break into the industry or trying to move up within the industry and they can't do it for whatever reason. Do you have a sense for like what is causing that phenomena?
Ooh, that's a can of worms because it's coming from the HR side and the hiring side and having unrealistic expectations of an entry level position. And, you know, you'll see it all the time. Entry level cybersecurity analyst, tier one analyst, but we need you to have, you know, an undergraduate degree in computer science and 5 years experience, for example. And I've seen that.
Yeah,
that's outrageous. You're not going to. So then what they did, the industry went into certifications. And if you're familiar with certifications, they're good. However, they only show one side of the candidate. And a lot of that is not an application side. It's very much academia. They were able to answer the correct questions. They got a certification. And these are both the academia route or the certification route isn't developing the talent that we need. And it's being harder and harder for HR individuals to hire the correct talent because you get them in. And if you've ever done a cybersecurity interview, they are super robust. They usually take, I've been in a few of them, and they take about, you know, three, maybe even five different interviews, depending on the position you're going into. And you get to these technical spots, and that's where a lot of these individuals just bomb because they don't have the hands-on. Mm-hmm. How are they supposed to get hands-on experience, though, if they can't get hired? So you have this like that we need to have more realistic expectations from the hiring and the HR side, but also from the individuals that are looking for the jobs. One of the things that somebody mentioned this, used this as an example, and I love it. He said, you know, we've got these candidates that are upset that they have to come to the table with some sort of experience, either certifications or academia or something, and they want to just get hired. So I have an argument to that because I think they should have some experience, either academia or certifications. I'm not a big certification fan, or self-taught. Go hack a box, build a lab, build out your GitHub, show me, create blogs, whatever your passion is about, go and do that on your own and show me you can do it for the next 6 to 8 months. That will teach me more about your skill set than academia and certification, because you think about it like medical school, a doctor. You're going to go into a surgeon's office and you're going to get your treatment. Do you want a doctor that has no hands-on experience? They have an entry-level position and they're going to do surgery on you? Of course not. They're going to have education to be able to go into that position. And the cybersecurity field needs to be viewed in that way. We are securing national and critical infrastructure. We are securing people's personal information, their PCI data. We need to start looking at these roles as, yes, education is important. It comes from both sides. Like, understand, I need to be educated for this role. I need to understand what I'm getting into. But then organizations need to have an onboarding, like on-ramp of 6 to 8 months where they can bring candidates on and they can teach them, what does a tier one do? What does this position do? Instead of expecting them to be at that level. So is this ever going to change? I think I've actually seen some organizations, they're doing this. I have a female that I mentor that she got a job. They brought her on and they put her in a training position for 6 months. And it was a temporary job. So they could let her go after 6 to 8 months if she didn't rise to the standard and meet the metrics. After 6 to 8 months, she got promoted into a phishing position, which now I would consider it probably she's probably a junior analyst instead of an associate analyst. Mm-hmm. That organization, I think more organizations need to do that. Yeah. Bring them in. There's 6 to 8 months, even a year, depending on their position. And they're not a full-time employee. They're a temporary employee, but they go through a training program. And I think that is going to help us better secure our infrastructure, but also increase our workforce, because we're not doing ourselves any good gatekeeping these individuals for coming in and not teaching them the skills. We're only doing more harm to ourselves as a cybersecurity community.
Yeah, I think the apprenticeship approach or /intern approach, or however that you want to structure that, is a really good one. The other thing that I've seen from my limited experience is I'm not sure that all folks entering the space have a really good grasp on just how many types of opportunities there are in cybersecurity. An example is, I know, like, for example, at Risk 360, we have Renegade Labs, which is our pen test practice. If we post a job position for that particular practice, we get like 300 applications. Yeah. Like, it's a ton. Everybody wants to be a pen tester. And it's people that like ranging from incredibly experienced people all the way to people who have like a finance background, but think pen testing might be cool. So tons of applications. But if I post something for like an IT auditor, like we do SOC 2 reports, for example, I want an IT auditor to do audits. That one gets like 50, like not nowhere near as much as the other one. And but there's a ton of demand for auditors. So I'm always telling people, especially entry-level candidates, say auditing might be a way to break in. A, because there's junior level positions open. B, because it pays well. C, because you're going to be able to get a really good grasp of like what security looks like from A to Z. But it's not sexy. It's not like no one wants to be an auditor. I don't think there's many people like, you know, going to college because they want to be an IT auditor. But it's a great career and it takes you all sorts of places. A lot of CISOs have backgrounds in that. Anyway, so I just think maybe there's some education where we can help people understand the variety, point them down specific career paths, apprenticeship programs. Those are all great ideas. What about diversity? I see this comes up. It's also like a controversial topic where maybe females are underrepresented in the space, people of color, that kind of thing. I don't have any data to back that up, but I do see a lot of talk on that. And instinctually, I think it's true. What do you think is the barrier to, for example, females getting into the space? Or is there a barrier? Where's that stand?
This is a great question. Coming from the military side and being in a very male-dominated industry, when I left the special ops environment and came in full-time into the cybersecurity space right after my deployment in 19, mm-hmm. I was a little surprised that it was still a very much male-dominated industry and that being a woman was, in air quotes, a thing. It was a little disheartening because I didn't think that that would be a thing. I'm like, oh, okay. We're going to be able to go in here and it'll be a great working environment. Now, it is a great working environment. I haven't had too many issues. I think that we're at 25 or 30% for women in the industry, and that's grown substantially. And don't quote me on that, but it's something Deidre Diamond actually talks about this all the time. I love that because she's all about diversity, but we've grown substantially just in the last couple of years for women specifically in the industry. And I think we're doing the right thing. I truly do. Again, the female lens. There's other areas that are underrepresented, like the Blacks. I think we only have 2%. Hispanics are a little bit lower, around maybe 4 or 5%. So we still have work to do. But I believe as a community, we're doing really good, at least within my ecosystem, the community that I've created and fostered around mentors and other cybersecurity professionals. I think one of the biggest things that we've kind of gotten rid of last 5 years is the toxic leaders. You know, if you weren't smart enough, people would put you down. Well, I don't see that. Is it still out there? Absolutely. But it's not as much. And people are allowing individuals, these new people, to come in and fail forward and be vulnerable and ask questions. And I think through that, we're going to see more diversity come into play. And I think we're doing a great job as a community. We can keep doing better, but I think we're doing a really good job. And it's coming into a good space. And I love to see the change. And I truly believe in the next 5 years, we're going to be sitting very good within the diversity space. That's my opinion on it, though.
Yeah. I mean, I think anytime people are talking about it, there's an opportunity for like forward momentum on any given topic, right? And I think there's no shortage of people talking about it right now. So you got to think that that's a good thing. And just the like pragmatism inside of me, the reason I know it's probably going to work out is because it has to. Like markets, we have such a talent shortage. So like people are doing anything they can to get good people in the space to solve that problem. So I just think no matter what, like, you know, if you're underrepresented in one spot, there's opportunity to go get some additional candidates there. So I think that's going to help drive it too. I do some work with a lot of the universities here in Georgia. So University of Georgia, Georgia Tech, Kennesaw State, all here in the Atlanta metro area. And all of them are pushing to get diverse folks into the STEM programs, one of which is cybersecurity. So even at that level, like the feeding programs into these larger programs into the professional space are focused on that too. So I'm optimistic that the talent problem from all dimensions will be solved over time. Mm-hmm. However, I think that the demand for people is likely going to outpace like our ability to produce those people anyway. Yeah. So, which is kind of nice. That's a good thing. You want to enter a space that you're really needed. So that's a good thing too. So good stuff. So where can people get the book? Cause I know people are going to want like career advice, how to get that. Is that something you have Amazon or a website?
It is Amazon. Easy. Just type in cybersecurity career master plan. You'll see it. Drop a 5-star review in there would be great. We're doing really well. We're really excited about the book. I know one of our co-authors is already, she's already going off on her own to make another book. She's crazy, but that's all right. I'm just trying to graduate grad school. I've got a full year left and then I'm going to probably write another book next year.
But, awesome. All right. If people want to get in touch with you, want to check out your consulting work, what's the best way to get in contact with you? Is there a website they can visit?
LinkedIn is easy. JAXS. You can find me or my company website, Outpost Gray, and Gray is the GRAY, not GREY. And that, you can find me on there. It's pretty easy.
Awesome. Well, Jax, thanks so much for being on the show, sharing your knowledge and contributing to the industry.
Absolutely, Christian. I'm going to have you on my show next.
Please do.
All right. Thanks.
Hey, thank you for watching Tuesday Morning Grind podcast. If you like content just like this from cybersecurity executives, thought leaders, hackers, then come on over to risk360.com. Check out our resource center where we have blog posts, white papers, videos, all for free that can teach you about cybersecurity. If you want to know more about cybersecurity certifications like ISO 27001, SOC 2, PCI, HITRUST, and others, we have a ton of content on that. So whatever you're looking for, we have a lot of resources. Head on over to risk360.com, shoot us a note, and we look forward to keeping the conversation going.